Welcome to NewsHour. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you on the BBC World Service live from our studio in London. Well, it's 1 year to the day when Hezbollah began airstrikes on Israel. The militant group based in Lebanon backed its assault in support of the October 7th Hamas attack on Israeli citizens. 1 year later, the landscape looks far different. Israel is widening its land operation inside Lebanon. It's aiming, it says, to eliminate Hezbollah as a threat on its border. Israel's military says one of its latest airstrikes on Beirut has killed another senior Hezbollah commander. A military spokesman said Suhail Husseini had been in charge of the group's logistics and had played a crucial role in weapons transfers with Iran. Hezbollah has not confirmed his death. And in the last few minutes, we've had news that the deputy leader of Hezbollah has said he supports a call from Lebanon's parliament for a ceasefire with Israel. Naim Qassem insisted that the group's military capacity remains intact, but this is thought to be the first time Hezbollah has voiced support for a ceasefire without tying it to a truce in Gaza. Well, for more on this, let's turn to our correspondent in Beirut, Lina Sinjab. Lina, let's start with the latest comments on a ceasefire from the deputy head of Hezbollah. This is getting attention. Can you just tell us about the significance of his comments?
Yes, I think we need to look at the context when he made these comments. So the speech today came a year after Hezbollah launched the attacks on Israel in support of the Palestinian, according to Hezbollah. It came also 2 weeks after the assassination of top leaders in Hezbollah, sending messages across that the Hezb is weakened and cannot respond to Israel. So that's why Mr. Qassem today is sending a message to Hezb supporter that they're still defiant, that they're still strong. But also he, praised the, what he calls the resistance fighters in the south. He praised those who are supporting from Shia militias in Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen. And then he commemorated the leadership and the efforts for ceasefire by the Speaker of the Parliament, Mr. Nabih Birri, who is also the second leader, Shia leader in Lebanon. So it seems to me that he is appeasing to the Shia community and trying to send assurances to the Shia community and send messages also to Nabih Birri, the Speaker of the Parliament, to lead and steer the wheel and that he is respected from Hezbollah's people. It's an internal message, I think, okay, while it's also appeasing for any peace efforts run
okay.
by
Okay, Lina, just very, very briefly, we don't have much time, but can you, we've mentioned recent assassinations, but can you tell us about the importance of the reported death of the senior military commander Suhail Husseini?
He's one of the running the logistics and also was in charge of trafficking all weapons, for Hezbollah. So it seems that it's like another big target for Israel on its list. However, we haven't heard yet from Hezbollah about his death or okay. the importance of his position within the ranks.
Okay, Lina, thank you very much. That was our correspondent in Beirut, Lina Sinjab. Well, staying in Lebanon, the country's former Prime Minister, Fouad Siniora, has told the BBC that the world has abandoned his country as Israel continues its war against Hezbollah. He'd complained there'd been a lack of initiative to end the conflict. Mr. Siniora also attacked the Iranian-backed Shia movement Hezbollah for dragging Lebanon into a war, which he said the majority of the population did not want. Mr. Siniora, a Sunni Muslim, was prime minister at the time of the last Israeli invasion in 2006. In an interview with the BBC, Mr. Siniora said Hezbollah was holding the government hostage.
Practically, the Lebanese as a state has been kidnapped by Hezbollah. And behind Hezbollah is Iran. This pistol or this gun that was held by Hezbollah, instead of being pointed towards Israel, it started to become pointed towards something else, towards domestically as a way of being used by Iran to interfere in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen.
Let's hear another point of view. Fadi Alameh is the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Lebanese Parliament. He's a member of parliament for the Amal movement, a Lebanese political party and former militia affiliated mainly with the Shia community of Lebanon and a parliamentary ally of Hezbollah. I asked him for his reaction to Fawad Senora's comments.
Let me just reiterate that the fact that Hezbollah as a political party is present in the parliament, has 15, I think, MPs in the Hezbollah group. They vote on legislations and they have a say-so like any other parliamentary bloc. And they represent a big chunk of Lebanese. Not everyone agrees with what they do or what they believe in. But again, in a democratic parliamentary system, they have a role to play.
But is this democratic, though? What other political party in Lebanon has its own armed militia?
Well, that's the issue that we also have to go back and discuss over and over and over. The statement that's issued by the cabinets every time we appoint a cabinet, where the government itself, the cabinet itself, has one of its, when it gets a vote of confidence, it mentions the Israeli aggressions and the Israeli and the Lebanese sovereignty and the right for the resistance from Lebanon until the last piece of land has been cleared and liberated. But let me just go back to one thing that's very important to understand, that what's happening now is probably in a way intended to create some political crisis in the country, which we want to avoid. We need unity. We need people behind the cabinet of Prime Minister Mikati. We should not allow only political bickering or business as usual that the Lebanese have gotten used to.
Mr. Alameh, I mean, you've certainly outlined what's at stake here in this conflict. I wonder if we can turn to the prospects for some kind of ceasefire. Now, the leader of your party, Nabi Berri, is leading negotiations on behalf of Hezbollah with the Americans. What are you hearing from him?
The speaker is leading the negotiations on the behalf of Lebanon. As you well know, we don't have a president. We have not been in agreement on the process of electing a president.
Just to focus on the ceasefire, though, negotiations for a ceasefire.
Not much is being done, unfortunately. Obviously, Israel is not interested in a ceasefire.
So I mean, there are reports in the Lebanese press that the Biden administration is asking for the full implementation of UN Resolution 1559. That's 20 years old and specifically calls for the disarming of all non-state militias. Is handing in Hezbollah's weapons now the American price for a ceasefire?
I'm not sure. I mean, the 1701, I think, covers a certain aspect of the previous resolution. And what we're talking about now as immediate ceasefire to stop the loss of innocent lives is to really try to get the 1701 in place.
Is it worth negotiating with the Americans? Are the Americans honest brokers as far as Lebanon is
concerned? Honestly, the U.S. is probably the strongest right now broker that can really bring about implementation of 1701 and maybe at least before that get a ceasefire in place. So we hope that this can be done soon, because again and again, lots of civilians are being, their lives are being lost. Lots of kids are not attending school now. We have over 1.2 million displaced all over the country. But this is not sustainable, given the magnitude of the bombardment, given the tension that we see all over in the south or in the southern suburbs of Beirut.
Fadi Alameh, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Lebanese Parliament, speaking to us from Beirut. Let's focus in on the people of Lebanon now. So many are on the move that the authorities in Lebanon have made schools the main shelters for displaced people. Approximately 1.2 million people have been displaced within the country since Israel stepped up air strikes last month. Imad Al-Ashkar is Lebanon's director for the Ministry of Education. Let's speak with him now. Mr. Al-Ashkar, tell us about the situation at the schools. What's happening there?
Hello. Yes, to talk about displaced, we have more than 800 shelters that have received displaced people. Among these, we have around 620 schools and institution buildings that been receiving these people that left or displaced. We have around 450,000 students among these displaced people from private and public sector, because we have a big 70% of our educational system is private sector. We have in these shelters around 33,000 families and more than 160,000 displaced in these shelters.
So 33,000 families. Are the schools equipped to handle that many displaced people?
That's start to create problems for us. So that's why we are managing to prepare these schools to make it to fit for the situation, or to use classes, or to use big classes to separate it in more than one room or two rooms to receive more people in these classes. It's challenging. We have water problems because schools are prepared to receive 200 or 300 students in it, and it's totally different from receiving families into these schools. We have start having a problem of garbage, removing garbage. It's becoming a big burden on the municipalities and on schools.
So, many families, so many children. Mr. Alashkar, yes. So many families, so many children located in one place. How confident are you that these schools will be safe from Israeli strikes?
It's not to me to answer this question. It's up to the Israeli. They must not bombard schools, but we have seen it in Gaza. They didn't blink an eye from bombarding schools or hospitals. So we are having schools in safe zones, between brackets, till now, and we have to pray not to be targeted into these schools.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. That was Imad Al-Ashkar, Lebanon's director for the Ministry for Education. You're listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Coming up, we speak to Geoffrey Hinton, who has just been woken up to be told he's won the Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on machine learning. He hopes the prize will give more weight to his warnings over the dangers of artificial intelligence.
Probably sometime in the next 20 years, we'll be able to build things more intelligent than ourselves. And we've never been there before. We have no idea what that's going to be like. Most people can't really imagine it. And a worry I have, and many other researchers have, is that if we build things more intelligent than ourselves, what's to stop them taking over?
And other stories we're covering this hour. The deputy leader of Hezbollah, Naim Qassem, has said he supports a call from Lebanon's parliament for a ceasefire with Israel after weeks of Israeli strikes that have killed many of the group's commanders and its leader. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. To the U.S. now, where thousands of people are fleeing the U.S. city of Tampa in Florida, as officials issue increasingly dire warnings about the threat posed by Hurricane Milton. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has said the Category 4 hurricane will make landfall in the next 48 hours and that residents should start implementing their evacuation plans. Milton is coming as the state's west coast is still emerging from the wreckage of Hurricane Helen, which hit less than 2 weeks ago. Helen is the deadliest storm to hit the area in years, killing more than 230 people and shredding buildings in its wake. And it's debris left by Helene that's posing a new challenge now. There are worries that the piles of glass, nails and branches could be whipped up by Milton's powerful winds, intensifying the threat. Well, let's speak now to Alan Archer, meteorologist at the Continental Weather Corporation, based in Tampa. Alan, what's it like where you are? Are preparations underway?
I'm looking at this big pile of branches in front of our office here that the garbage guys were supposed to pick up yesterday. They didn't. And I'm afraid that if our winds get to 100 miles an hour here in about 36 hours from now, that those branches are going to go flying all over the place. And in other areas of Tampa, where they had even worse damage from Helene, there's pieces of appliances, wood, pieces of roof that haven't been picked up yet. And you can just imagine.
Can you just tell us about Hurricane Milton? How powerful a storm is it heading towards Tampa anyway? And then how much more dangerous is it because we still have all the debris left by Helene?
Right. This is considered a Category 4 hurricane. There's five categories. Five is the most intense. One is the least intense. This is a Category 4. Now, it's strong. Wasn't as strong as yesterday, because yesterday this thing like exploded to about 180 mile an hour sustained wind. Now it's decreased to 145 mile an hour sustained wind, which is still a major hurricane. And there's a little bit of uncertainty, though, I got to admit, where it's going to make landfall along the west coast of Florida. The European model, which the British Isles model, is really good at forecasting, you know, hurricanes, where they're going. That, along with the American models, are suggesting Tampa late tomorrow, early Thursday. But some of the high-resolution models, the most recent developing models, suggest that it may take a more southerly track, about 60, 90 kilometers south of Tampa. If that be the case, Tampa wouldn't get as bad an impact, but areas like Fort Myers, Naples, those areas of southwest Florida could be more directly impacted.
So there sounds like there's a lot of doubt then in these forecasts. Is it unusual, though, to have a hurricane like this striking a similar area in such a short space of time?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, especially these two, you know, these two storms, very, very intense. Helene's very intense, produced a 6 to 7 foot, just over 2 meters storm surge along the west coast of Florida. And now this one here has actually potential of producing twice the storm surge. In other words, the wind from the hurricane pushes on the water, forces the water, like a wall of water, to move in towards the beach areas. And that's why it causes so much destruction right along the immediate coastline. In addition to the interior parts of Florida, like if you've ever been to Orlando, like Disney World, those areas could get 100 mile an hour wind gusts. So we got people all over Florida that are, many of them are leaving their homes to safer ground.
Okay, Alan, I hope that you're able to get to safer ground as well. That was Alan Archer, meteorologist at the Continental Weather Corporation based in Tampa. The death of a teenage girl in France is one of 46 cold cases European police are seeking to solve as part of the second phase of a wider campaign titled Operation Identify Me. The details of each victim has been published on Interpol's website, along with photographs of possible identifying items and facial reconstructions. The BBC's Anna Holligand joined French detectives at the scene of the teenager's murder.
It was in this area.
Okay. We're walking by the side of a road in Le Cellier, down to the spot where the murdered teenager's body was found.
He may have dropped the body from the road.
A pair of red shoes and a British 10p coin are among the very few clues.
I'm a superintendent, head of the office in charge of serious and violent crimes in France.
How would you describe this area?
It's a quiet place to dispose a body. Maybe to commit a murder too. It's possible that a murder was committed there. From the road, you cannot see what happened there.
Is this the case file?
Yes. From that skull?
That is her skull.
That was her skull. When she was found, there was more skin. There was still hair.
The newspaper at the time.
Leontine Galois is the producer. with me here in Le Cellier, and she's been going through some old newspaper articles.
The journalist suggests that she might have been a victim of a car crash or a hitchhiker that got abused by a car driver. What do you think of these theories?
There is no sign on the body related to a car crash, but there is evidence that there was a murder.
But it's such a quiet village, you would think when there is a teenager's body found in a ditch by the side of the road, it would trigger some memory.
We are very often confronted to people are not aware of what tragedy has happened just nearby.
Then Leontine receives a call from a woman who remembers.
At the time, she was scared, but no one really talked about it that much.
Because she probably wasn't local.
Yeah, she told me for sure she was not. No one knew her.
The ease of movement due to open borders, increased global migration and human trafficking has led to more people being reported missing outside of their home country.
All right, let's get in. When you come to the dunes, where they go up, you have these beautiful pathways, which are a bit more isolated.
The woman in the dunes was Detective Sandra Bassbank's first case 22 years ago.
Take you up to where we found her. And as you can feel, she must have been, you know, strong and fit to take this walk.
She remembers seeing the body with no obvious signs of injury or a struggle.
She was lying here, face down, in the sand, wearing red shoes, shiny. So that was a bit odd. If the scenario would have been that she was laying there and somebody would have been with her and pressing the head in the sand, maybe, but I just don't have the evidence for it. But that's the thing with the dunes. The wind blows and the sand washes away. So we don't have any evidence. The one thing she had in her pocket was 3 keys.
One of the keys she was carrying was eventually traced back to Germany. But then the leads went cold. For your first case to be a cold case must be frustrating, like you can't close the book.
That's true. But maybe, I'm just thinking, maybe she gave me a chance to be good at what I do. To always give that little bit extra to, you know, never give up.
And that motto resulted in the identification of a British woman, Rita Roberts, 31 years after she was murdered in Belgium. Her family recognised a distinctive black rose tattoo that appeared in a BBC report about the first Identify Me campaign.
I couldn't breathe. I had to sit down. My body just shook.
Rita's sister Donna hopes other families will get the same sense of closure.
I know where she is and she's at peace, and that is most important.
That report from Anna Holligan. And you can read more from Anna about this latest police campaign, Operation Identify Me, on the BBC News website. More to come on NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Geothermal energy has seen sluggish growth rates in comparison to other renewables like solar and wind power. It's expensive to develop sources of underground heat, and even when successful, projects usually offer a low return on an investment. But now a new technology developed by a company in Germany could make geothermal much more profitable. Host of the Climate Question podcast, Grayer Jackson, went to see how they do it.
Christian Freitag shows me a bunch of shipping containers stacked on top of each other. Wires, pipes and shiny steel scaffolding connect them all together, framing the blue and cloudless sky above us.
So typically at a geothermal plant, you suck up that hot water and that steam, you extract the heat, and then you plug it back down into the ground again. But you've got an extra step in the process where you extract lithium from the geothermal waters or brines.
That's correct. This salty water has been down there for millions of years. And one of these salts is lithium chloride. This is a very valuable product for the battery materials and car manufacturing industry.
How valuable is it?
So if you look at our project, we are of course selling power and heat, but the main contribution to our revenues comes indeed from the lithium. It's more than 80%.
Wow!
Yeah, and that's why producing a critical raw material and at the same time providing renewable, sustainable heat and power to the nearby communities is such an ideal combination. It's really a win-win situation.
It is a win-win situation, yes. But really, the wind comes from the lithium. Geothermal power alone isn't all that profitable. But if you extract lithium, this critical metal, you can make some real money. In fact, Vulcan Energy Resources have pre-sold all their lithium for nearly the next decade.
This is a demonstration plant and very, very similar to the commercial plant that we are going to build. There we will produce 24,000 tons of lithium a year. And to put that in perspective, that will be good for around about 500,000 electric cars per year.
So basically you'll be able to provide all the lithium for the German car market?
If you will.
We've just opened two double doors to see three sort of metal vats similar to what you would see in beer breweries.
We are standing right in front of the core of everything. It's like three vessels which are filled with a filter media, if you will. We call it sorbent. And this sorbent filters or extracts the lithium out of the brine.
Can I think of this a bit like a water filter or a sponge that absorbs the lithium but nothing else?
Yeah, you can. It's a purely physical process. Unfortunately, I can't show you the lithium chloride, but I can show you a container which is filled with water. And believe me, there's lithium in there. And there's a lot of value in that container, as much as 10,000 euros.
And you've just got it out here on display. It's not even locked up. It's outside.
Yeah, well, try to carry it away.
Yes, that's a good point.
Geothermal has a huge upfront cost, but maybe extracting lithium from the hot water could make it much more profitable and much more attractive to investors and energy companies, as the return on investment is much faster and doesn't rely on public funding as much.
Host of the Climate Question podcast, Greer Jackson. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. I'm Celia Hatton. And Kamala Harris has given a wide-ranging interview to the American television network CBS ahead of the presidential election next month. The Democratic Party candidate defended the Biden administration's efforts to prevent all-out war in the Middle East, even though Israel has repeatedly brushed aside U.S. appeals for restraint. She was responding to a question from the host, Bill Whitaker, of 60 Minutes, on whether the United States had any sway over Prime Minister Netanyahu.
The work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
We are not going to stop pursuing what is necessary for the United States to be clear about where we stand on the need for this war to end.
Ms. Harris's comments come as we hear the news that Israel's ground operation is expanding into Lebanon's southwest, bringing the total number of deployed Israeli troops there to 15,000. And Israel is now warning people inside Lebanon to avoid the coast, indicating it has no plans to retreat. All this as Israel continues its assault on Gaza and faces ongoing threats from Iran and the Houthis in Yemen. So today, in special coverage across BBC News, we're examining the prospects for peace and asking how this complex conflict might come to an end. Joining us live is Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a career diplomat. Ambassador, thank you for joining us. How, in your view, does the United States want this conflict come to an end?
Thank you. Well, I believe we have made it clear from the beginning. The president spoke about a day after, early in the conflict between the IDF and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, that we have a long-term view about securing Israel's safety, security, and peace, one that is still not shared, apparently, by the prime minister. So we have called for ceasefires. We have facilitated discussions. We know that it is through diplomacy that the hostages are returned safely, recognizing that the vast majority of hostages were returned via diplomacy, that the IDF has killed nearly as many as it has saved from the Gaza Strip. And certainly warning against this wider expansion of the war where we find ourselves now. So as you heard from the vice president and you've heard from the president and other senior leaders, we believe there is a appropriate diplomatic off-ramp and that it is important not to expand it further.
Can you tell us more about this appropriate diplomatic off-ramp?
Well, I mean, these negotiations have been going on in Qatar, supported by the international community and certainly by leaders in the region, to find a way to get to that off-ramp. So we mm-hmm. have had proposals put forward several times over the last year with hope expressed by the U.S. government that this could be the way, and occasionally agreement by the Israeli government, only to find backtracking. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't to say that the Israelis are the only ones that are making this difficult. This, of course, comes from Hamas on the other side. And of course, if Hezbollah had adhered to UN Security Council Resolution 1701 mm-hmm. in 2006, we also would not be here today.
You're focusing, or you have been focusing a lot on a potential ceasefire with Gaza. I wonder if we can also talk about what's going on with Hezbollah and yeah. in Lebanon. Washington appears to support Israel targeting Hezbollah, but are there fears that Israel's limited operation, or what it describes as a limited operation, will turn into a larger scale prolonged conflict?
I believe we've made that clear. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. They did not adhere to 1701. They bear that responsibility. And of course, any time that you are voluntarily entering into conflict, which Hezbollah did, then you are taking chances. There are consequences to behavior. Calculations, miscalculations have always been available, and something that the community that watches and analyzes this has been warning against. Even as they had a tit for tat over the last 11 months that seemed to calibrate and work toward not escalating, the possibility for mistakes was always there. That's what happened when they killed Israeli children in the north. They, mm. those children were not targets. Mm. Miscalculations, mistakes, lone wolves, as it were. So the United States certainly cannot gainsay or criticize anyone or any government that is pursuing a terrorist organization and terrorists that have brought about the loss of Israeli life and indeed American life. But that certainly was not something we would do.
Ambassador, just very briefly, do you think that the Biden administration can really trust its relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu?
Yes, well, that is an interesting word, because certainly there have been times when the president and the secretary of state have come out with one view only to have it overturned by the prime minister. It is clear that there are significant times when, if not at cross purposes, there is a failure to communicate in an honest and consistent manner between Israel and the United States.
Ambassador, thank you. That was Ambassador Gina Abercrombie-Winstanley. Gina Abercrombie-Winstanley was a U.S. ambassador to Malta under Barack Obama. She served 30 years in the State Department. Let's go to China now. And another day, another announcement that more senior officials have been kicked out of the ruling Communist Party for corruption. This time, the former Justice Minister Tang Yijun is accused of helping family members obtain business deals while also taking bribes for himself. And he is just one of many ongoing corruption cases in what's become a key centerpiece of Xi Jinping's time in power. Well, for more on this, let's speak with Carrie Allen, the BBC Monitoring's China social media analyst. Carrie, can you just briefly tell us more about the news out today?
Yes, so there are a lot of newspaper reports today saying that China's anti-graft agency, which is the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, has been given approval by China's central government to investigate at least three senior officials. And we're talking about officials at a provincial level, So yes, along with Tang Yijun, there's also a former political advisor for the Xinjiang region and the former deputy head of Inner Mongolia's standing committee. And again, there's similar accusations. So things like accepting gifts, money, vouchers, or taking advantage of their power to seek benefits.
I mean, this all seems really routine, doesn't it, Carrie? What about Xi Jinping's campaign against corruption? He started it when he first came into power. It's one of the first things he announced. But no one, I think, realized at the time that it would drag on for so long.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is so routine that there are projections that there have been around 2.3 million government officials that have been prosecuted over the years. And Xi Jinping came, he became leader back in 2013. And yes, it was one of his big campaigns at the time to crack down on what he described as tigers and flies, which are both high-level officials and local civil servants. So so this is something that's been going on for a long period of time. And it's just so common for me to see media reports that say, yes, another official today is under investigation.
Yeah, 2.3 million. That's just a staggering number. Now, you follow Chinese public opinion very closely. Is anyone questioning publicly how and why officials are so bold as to engage in corruption, even after Xi Jinping has punished so many already?
Well, it's so difficult for people to do so because China's media environment is so tightly controlled. And social media platforms like Sina Weibo, they're also heavily monitored. And if anybody tries to voice an opinion that's critical about China's leadership, and even if they're talking very small level officials, still they are people in China's leadership. So so any kind of comments that will be critical of government officials, they're very, very quickly wiped. And it's suspected that the government pays people to post messages that are positive of the government. So yeah, if anyone wants to post anything critical, okay. Very, very difficult.
Carrie, thank you for taking us through that. Carrie Allen from BBC Monitoring. Now, yesterday was Vladimir Putin's 72nd birthday, but he might be smarting from an unwelcome gift. The news that part of his summer residence has reportedly been demolished. The independent Russian investigative outlet Project said satellite imagery shows that the main building of one of Mr. Putin's residences on the Black Sea had been demolished in February and March, leaving a pit and construction equipment in its place. The Russian leader was reportedly increasingly reluctant to visit the property because of dangers posed by Ukrainian drone attacks. But for more on this, let's speak with Samuel Romani. He's an associate fellow at the defense and security think tank RUSI. He's also the author of Putin's War on Ukraine. Mr. Romani, what do you make of this report from Project on the possible demolition of this building?
Well, I mean, it's obviously impossible to confirm entirely, but I can say that Project is a very good investigative journalist outlet inside Russia that can produce usually accurate reporting. So I think we should definitely take it seriously. Also, I think it's important to keep in mind that the Ukrainians have been stretching their ability to launch drone strikes on the Black Sea coast and on Russian areas near it. They've been threatening Krasnodar, and the Russians have shot down drones over there. And there were reports earlier this month that Sochi was actually in their crosshairs, because Sochi is a key location for Russian helicopters that can be used and deployed on the front lines to bomb Ukrainian cities.
You mentioned Sochi. Many people might know that name. That's where the Winter Olympics was staged a few years ago. Can you tell me more about the residence that was possibly demolished?
Well, Sochi is a very important city for Vladimir Putin. It's been basically his favorite place for some of the most high-profile summits and meetings that he's had, whether it be meetings on Syria with the Iranians and the Turks, often taking place inside Sochi, whether it be the Russia-Africa summit of 2019, the Olympic Games, like you just said. And this particular villa and residence was a Stalin-era palace. It was really inaugurated, I think, around 1955, so just after Stalin's death. But it was modernized subsequent to that. And it's hosted people like George W. Bush, Erdogan, David Cameron, many, many high-profile figures over the years.
So do you see a logic in its possible destruction then?
Well, I think that it would probably be a precautionary move to deter or prevent the Ukrainians from obviously carrying out some kind of an attack or targeted assassination of Putin. I think that the fears of that happening rose when Kirill Budanov, the head of the GUR, the military intelligence agency, hinted at that. And we've been looking at the wave of attacks from Ukraine on pro-Russian figures and the drone over the Kremlin. I think it's a precautionary move that's important. Also, I think it'll be aimed at making Sochi a less desirable target for Ukraine's military resources. And that they're hoping that, you know, if Sochi is exempt, then they can continue to keep some of their helicopters there.
Samuel, thank you. That was Samuel Romani. He's an associate fellow at the defense and security think tank RUSI. He's also the author of Putin's War on Ukraine. You're listening to NewsHour. Lots more to come. Stay with us.
This is NewsHour coming to you on the BBC World Service. Well, it's the phone call that many scientists dream of getting. And today it went to Geoffrey Hinton. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences rang him to tell him he'd won the Nobel Prize in Physics. The Canadian-British researcher is known as a pioneer in developing machine learning, which has become a foundation for artificial intelligence. He's also an outspoken critic of the dangers posed by AI. I spoke with Professor Hinton a short time ago, and I began by asking him about that famous phone call.
My phone went off at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was a call from Sweden saying I won the Nobel Prize in Physics. And my first thought was, how do I know this isn't a spoof call? Because I wasn't expecting this. I never expected to win the Nobel Prize in Physics.
And what does this mean to you?
It means a lot. In particular, it means that people will take my warnings about AI safety more seriously.
Tell us about your work. I want to talk about AI and your feelings about artificial intelligence, but just tell us about the work that won you the prize.
According to what they said in their press conference, it was for two pieces of work. One was work with Terry Sanofsky on something called Boltzmann machines that was showing how to take things called hop field nets, which are a kind of neural network, and make them able to learn more complicated things. And Terry and I came up with a very neat algorithm. But that's not what led to the big engineering breakthroughs. So I also did work with another of my mentors called David Rummelhart, who died very young of a nasty brain disease, on something called backpropagation. And backpropagation is a learning procedure that's used in all the neural networks now. And that's what's allowed us to build these great big chatbots.
You've talked a lot about your work and how it's fed into sort of the wider world around artificial intelligence. I wonder if you can tell us, you know, about your safety concerns regarding AI.
So probably sometime in the next 20 years, we'll be able to build things more intelligent than ourselves. And we've never been there before. We have no idea what that's going to be like. Most people can't really imagine it. And a worry I have, and many other researchers have, is that if we build things more intelligent than ourselves, what's to stop them taking over? And of course, what we really care about people. We're people, and what we care about is people. So we'd rather stay in control. But we don't know how to do that. And so we need young researchers to be, with flexible minds, to be working on that problem right now to make sure we can stay in control. And we need governments to force the big companies to provide them the resources they need. So if you look at what's happened with OpenAI, initially they were very concerned about safety, but now they're much more concerned with profits, and most of their safety researchers have left. And that's a bad thing for the long-term future of humanity.
Just to circle back, now that you've won this prize, do you think it will embolden you more? Will it give you more of a platform to speak about this?
I was pretty bold anyway, I think, but it will make people take me more seriously, I think.
And how are you going to celebrate?
I'm going to try and get some sleep. It's the middle of the night here.
That was the University of Toronto Professor Geoffrey Hinton. He's a Canadian-British researcher. And we should add that he has shared that Nobel Prize in Physics with the American Professor John Hopfield, who's a professor at Princeton University in the United States. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, more than 6,000 metres up Chukumba Mountain in northern India is not a spot generally frequented by the faint of heart. Even less so when a storm is raging and visibility is minimal. Not ideal circumstances, really, in which to hear or see a rock snap the rope connecting you to your food, tent and climbing equipment, which promptly disappears into the snowy forever. And that's what happened to the British climber, Faye Manners, and her climbing partner, the American Michelle Dvojak, who went missing in the Himalayas, where before they were thankfully found by rescuers. Now, the BBC's Amal Rajan has been speaking to Faye and Michelle. Michelle began by describing that moment when the rope snapped.
It was pretty scary. I mean, when you pull on loose rock and you start to fall a little bit, it's pretty jarring. But I think when we realized that we'd also lost our kit, pretty big feeling of disappointment between the two of us.
As putting it mildly. Faye, what did you say to each other at that point?
Oh, there was a big, big, long sense of silence between us. There weren't too many words to begin with, to be honest. It was more just the gaze that we had between us, the look of just disappointment and disbelief. I think we were in silence for probably at least 2 or 3 minutes before we said anything.
Okay,
I think we both knew what was to come.
And I was going to say, you were stranded on you're able to communicate with the search and rescue team by text. You were stranded on a ledge. Just describe the conditions. How big was the space you occupied? How cold was it?
It was really small. I mean, we could both sit up on the ledge, but we couldn't lay down. The hardest thing is we still have other equipment. And so you have to fit like both your bodies and your sleeping bag on there, but you also have to fit all your other equipment there. And once you've already lost a lot of your kit down the mountain, then you get pretty anxious about the rest of the kit that you have. So when you're in a really small space...
Michelle, like I said, you look rather anxious just sort of recounting the story, which is understandable because, Michelle, the helicopter, the rescue helicopter came, but when it first came for you, you saw it, but they couldn't see you.
Exactly. Yeah, we were waving our hands around and hoping to get their attention, but they were just a bit too far away and we were on a pretty steep and vertical face. And I think everything looked a bit the same to them from their vantage point.
Okay, and Faye, you made this decision to abseil down the side. Were you hypothermic at this point?
Yeah, we'd already had 2 evenings on the wall where I didn't have any of my warm clothing because it was in the equipment bag. So I was particularly cold and I just knew that I couldn't spend another night pretty much shivering all night. So at that point, I was like, we really just have to try and get ourselves out of this situation and go down. I think I'd preferred to go down without the right equipment and give ourselves some sort of hope of survival rather than just sit another night and freeze.
That was the British climber Faye Manners and her climbing partner, the American Michelle Dvojak, speaking to the BBC's Amol Raja. Now, if you want more from this story, you can go to the BBC News website where you can see photos of Faye and Michelle smiling after they've been rescued, standing with their rescuers. They said they cried when they were finally found. Now, from me, Celia Hatton, and from the rest of the team on NewsHour, that's all from us for now. But thank you for listening.